Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
We left off in the middle of chapter 7. 31? Thank you. We did. Okay, excellent. So I want to... I get very humbled when we do these verses, especially describing the building, when I tell you I can't bring them, make them come alive. In other words, the measurements and the truth is, in the parshas that we do also, we struggle with that, meaning that they're like different measurements, and we don't know how to inspire ourselves from measurements, this many beams and this much wood, and the... There is a rule, it's an interesting rule. Some people find that those areas of the Torah which seem the most mundane, they hide the most secrets in. And there are areas like that, like where it says, for example, the list of like Asaph's sons. They're like incredible amount of literature that, or the name of the different places where they stopped in the desert. And so you say to yourself, well, I don't plan on taking that trip through the desert anytime soon. So this was a long time ago. There must be new stops by now. So what do we need to know where they stopped? Well, each one of the stops actually was a stage of growth. It wasn't the actual name of the place. It signified the steps throughout life as they were going from being a slave to being a free person and the growth of the nation. And you could study that on a whole different level. On the other hand, you could just read it like a street sign. Oh, went to this street, to this street, to this street. Or, as a people, these are the stages that you go to develop as a nation. And so, to some extent, though, we're just learning this on a very, basic level. These were the things that were built by Shlomo HaMelech, who was the wisest of all men, and they were for use in the holy place. And they had a special use. We don't know exactly what they look like, and we don't know why there's such detail was recorded, even hundreds of years later, after they were built, why they were done. We do know that they weren't allowed to just tinker or just to build something on their own. There had to have been a divine mandate, which means that there was something special about the measurements and what they did. But some of it's been lost, and some of it would take a different kind of study to get to the bottom of. So the one thing that we finished, more or less, was what's called the Yam Shel Shlomo, the Sea of Solomon. You hear that today because there was a famous rabbi named Solomon who wrote a beautiful book, and he called it Yam Shel Shlomo. So you'll hear that sometimes, the Yam Shel Shlomo Sea said. But it's because the rabbi chose that name for his book. If you ever write a book, you want to find a verse in the Torah to name your book. And so you take your name, and so that's where a lot of books are like that. So the famous book, Yam Shel Shlomo, I think it was Shlomo Luria or Shlomo something. But the Sea of Shlomo, so we know it was like a giant mikvah. And we know it had the cows at the bottom. Here's a picture that they have. That's this on right here. Now they know that it was round towards the top and square towards the bottom. Now the cows are misleading in that one of the rules of the mikvah is that we humans by nature are physical, are flesh and blood, and we're prone to mistakes. And Hashem is eternal and is almighty, and He created us pure. And when we go to the mikvah, what we seek to do is to undo the mistakes of flesh and blood, undo the mistakes that mankind has, that we've done because we are human. And so we go back to the divine, which, there are a lot of verses in Genesis and Bereshit where it talks about the world being a water and being a pool, and we go back to the original source. Now, one of the rules of a mikvah is that in order to be kosher mikvah water, a human can't have done anything with the water. It has to be natural. It has to be like either a natural well or a natural spring. Or what they do today typically is they have a way where they gather rainwater into it without putting it into a vessel, without putting it through a pipe. because that would be a human. The laws of Tzchach are very similar to that. When we make a roof for the sukkah, we also have to be straight from Hashem. We can't have, you know, we can't use boards or bricks, or it has to be something that humans have not. We have a way that sometimes when we tamper with things, you know, they're not in the best. So we sometimes need to go back to our roots or to the. So this being a mikvah could not be above ground. So you couldn't have the sea, this giant thing, on top of the cow's back. So it had to have been. So they think that the cows were just like a that the underground pool came up through the cows somehow, and the cows were like an image. But again, it's just it's not clear how it looked or what it looked like. The we're always shocked when we hear about cows because we know the golden calf. But we have to understand also, why would a cow be chosen? And
a bull is chosen.
The one of our greatest people, his name was Yosef HaTzadik. And he, when Yaakov wished to bless him, he said, he's an ox. Meaning like he's, and I was, there is some symbolism of being like a cow is one of the greatest creatures in a sense that it works hard, it doesn't complain, it doesn't attack people, it provides food. And without cows, we wouldn't have steaks, we wouldn't have grain, it does the plowing, it does the, it's a beast of burden. And so it's no coincidence that we look to, you know, we want to be like a cow with brains, you know, like we want to be able to work, get, you know, get the job done and be domesticated and not harm, you know, it's not a, and then there's certain things that we, you know, we compare Yehuda to the lion, you know, he's the leader and he, you know, he can, you know, a lion's not afraid of other creatures and it goes, you know, and it goes on the offensive and it, so there are different things that we're supposed to see from the animal world that if we studied them, we would view life in a special way. And so there is an idea that Hashem's throne was surrounded by different creatures. And when Yehezkel had a vision of Hashem's throne, there was a lion on one side, and there was a cow on the other, there was different. And so therefore, when we see Hashem, there's something that we're supposed to learn from the cow. So much so that when they wanted to build an image of God, they built a golden calf. So they blew it, but what were they thinking? There had to have been some reason that they thought the cow, maybe the Indians don't have it all wrong, you know, in India with the cow. They also know there's something. They worship the cow, right. So there's something to it. The mistake was they went too far. You know, God does, you know, the cow was not God and it doesn't, but for us to say there's nothing to learn from the cow or nothing to see, it's just because we're not around them. We don't see what the impression is. But I'm sure there's many secrets that could be unlocked there. But this was the first of the things that were built, and in subsequent generations they weren't able to build such things. Today it would leak. You know, if you build something of that size and hold water, it wouldn't. Today you can go and the things that the ancients built, they lasted hundreds of years. Today we have a hard time making anything that lasts very long at all. Yeah. So. Moving right along, we'll start at verse 30, I guess. So that was the, like I said, the well of Shlomo, called the Yam Shel Shlomo. Then we have the, they needed a lot of water in the Beis HaMikdash. I said right now where I do the daily page, and that's a study where there are thousands of people study that all over the world. It's probably the most popular class that is around. And we're studying the section that deals with the temple, the Tzvachim. And the more you study it, the more you're amazed at how they did it. How did they track it? In other words, you had hundreds of thousands of people coming to this area, and there were very specific rules how everything had to be done and had to be processed. And let's say a person came with their family and they were coming and they just wanted to have a family get together. So that would be a shlamim, a peace offering. So in the peace offering, so Hashem gets a little piece of fat from the back And then the rest of the meat goes back to the person, and they have like a steak dinner with their family, and that was done. Now, if a person is a sin offering, then you don't get the steak dinner. That goes to the Kohanim, and they get most of it. And then if you have, there's a Thanksgiving offering, if a person has a certain occasion, if they have a recovery, or if they're free from prison, and then that comes with loaves of bread. And each thing had to be sent in the temple, and there was an order where everything went, and you had to know they would process it, and then afterwards it would go back to the owner, and some would go to the Kohanim, and some would, and you just had how they track things without a computer, and if the Kohen had, if he's thinking this was for your this sin, I thought it was for that sin, malpractice, you need a new Kohen. They had.
Were there no written rules, tablets, manuscripts, anything that they could have found that had all of this already?
It's possible, but they didn't use writing like we did. It was more on tablets or things. They did have like little, things that they would. There were things that they would. The person would pay for an offering, and then he'd get a ticket to go get. I want a sheep. I want a goat. And they had. But it was a massive undertaking. One of the things that they would have needed a lot of was water, because they would have needed to, after they killed the animals, they need to wash them. And they need to soak them and salt them, and they was also the Kohanim needed to wash their hands. And in between changing, when they went to the mikveh, there was a need of a lot of water. So how did they? They didn't have plumbing like we have, in the building. So how did they? So they had these water containers. What does he call it? Water. Water wash basins. I think a basin would be the right word. And they were movable. They were on wheels. And so he's describing here the basin, the wheel basin for the wash basin.
Have you talked about the pipes that come, where the pipes came for Simchat Bet HaShoeva, where the water came from the earth? It's in this area also? Was this in Yerushalayim related to this, where there was...
Yeah, there were wells and there were water areas where water came from, but you had to pick it up from the ground and bring it, to the where the Kohanim would wash their hands or where the meat was or where they were processing the... Yeah.
Do you think the fact that there were sort of spigots coming from this mix and people would line up and wash their hands and feet?
It didn't show that in the picture. Right now we're describing, we kind of finished with the sea, that giant mikvah, and now we're talking about separate wash basins on wheels that were throughout the temple.
So why would they need those if they had the sea and people could line up around?
Because you had to bring the water to the, if you have a side of beef, or you need the water over there. Verse 30, in chapter 7. Arba ofan echoshel v'chuna. Now we're describing the wheel basin. They couldn't have rubber wheels; those would wear out, so they had copper wheels. V'sarin echoshel arba pamosav kesev v'chuna. The times look here; they had four copper boards underneath the basin. And they got a little bit of a picture here. This is like the copper wheel, support basin. You got the four sides and the wheel, and again there must be a significance to it, but he just attempts to draw it. 31. Upili basic, so we could pass it out afterwards. The opening of the basin was an amma, was a foot and a half. Upi alva masik in amma, was an amma and a half. He's describing the sides. Now these were square, not round. 32. And he's describing the axles of the wheels. So again, why would they go into the axles of the wheels of the wash basin for the? So there's something here, but I don't know the deeper meaning. But yet, the Fana Makunu come with the open echad, and the size was 1.5 by 1.5. Now,
maybe they did that for future
to rebuild them, right? Mm-hmm. But there must be a reason why it had to look like that. Why it had to be, the umaisa fanikamaisa vanamokhava. And it's similar to a chariot wheel, if you know what a chariot wheel was. Yadosavagadeh vishavitim hakomutsuk. Everything was cast. It all had to be copper. there was, again, a reason why certain metals were used and not. Why couldn't it be silver? Why couldn't it be... Apparently that was part of the need. And he said there are four shafts at the four corners. He's describing he described the four wheels, and then there's the basin built on that, and then the water container will go on that. Now, there were different images. So, first of all, we have the cherubs. That's the, usually those are like young children. We often talk about that, and that's one of the divine images. Hashem loves the, loves the purity of children, the innocence of children. There's the idea that we have to stay young, that we have to be young at heart, and that's the different symbolism why Hashem wanted in the Beis Hamikdash this idea of children. The idea that we're not supposed to grow old. We're supposed to stay young at heart. Yes. That's right. They can do no wrong. They have no, that's true. That's true. That's an image. So you have on one side, you have the cherubs. Then you have the Orias, the lions, which is means that in life, sometimes people have to be a lion. They have to be willing to take on the world. And throughout our history, it was the Jew always, the world said, you believe in God. Where's your God? You don't have any statues. Where's the, and he said, well, I believe in Hashem that doesn't have a form, and then the Romans would throw the handicapped to the lions. They felt there was no need for them. And we said, no, we have to take care of the handicapped and the elderly and the, throughout history, it's been the Jew whose job it was to stand up for what was right, the Timros. And it also describes like a palm tree. I'm not sure. Kamari Ish Valio Savi. And these images sound pretty. I mean, a palm tree, I don't know the significance of it.
So when they break and when the winds come, they don't break like other trees.
Oh, I see. Okay, very good. The flexibility of the palm tree. Okay. Because those also said, this is how they made these 10 wash basins. It's so interesting, when you go to purify yourself, you want the innocence of the child and then the zeal of the lion, maybe the flexibility of the... You try to get all the images together. Musa Nidah has cut the back of the kula. Okay. And then we get to 38. The Yasa Sorokinos. And then he made 10 of these wash basins. He calls them lavers, though. They're like big buckets or big things with a spigot on the side for washing. Our boy in Bas Yochel, Hakir Echad, and they held, had to hold quite a bit of water. He calls it 40 bath measures. Our boy in Bas Yochel, 40 measures. Call 40 gallons, let's say. Hakir Echad, Arba, Bama, Hakir Echad, Hakir Echad, Amakona, Azlas, and so they had 10 altogether. Now, where did they put these wash basins? 39. They had 5 on the right and 5 on the left. It was kind of, I guess when you walked up to the Beis Hamikdash, they were kind of equally divided on both sides. That's the Yan Nosen. Now, where did he put the sea? That was put on the right side, Kedma, Mimul. That was opposite of the Sapi. Okay, we continue on, 40. The Yaskirim at the Kiris Vesayoyim. Now, those were the big utensils. What about the small utensils? There's a significance to this. We all know we have a custom to have salt at our table. There's a Jewish custom on Shabbos that we used to have salt on the table. And the reason why is that when we describe the Beis Hamikdash, it mentions that the Beis Hamikdash, we were required to have salt, to prepare things with salt. And it describes the covenant of salt. And the idea of salt is a preservative. They didn't have refrigeration, and things go bad. Meat would go bad, other things would go bad, and salt keeps things from going bad. In the old days, that's where they started with salamis and things, because that preserved the meat. That was the only thing, corned beef. Why? Because you didn't have refrigeration. That was a way of keeping meat so that it wouldn't go bad. We started out with an amazing relationship with Hashem. We're going to see. They brought the Aron, and everybody was there, and the divine presence, and we were in love, and we were. The challenge is to keep it fresh. We all have those moments of inspiration, is not to let it go spoiled. And so that's the challenge of salt, which is to keep our relationship with Hashem fresh. Don't allow it to disintegrate. And that's really the challenge in life, which is to stay fresh or to stay young. And the reason that we have salt in our table is that on Shabbos, our table is like the temple. In other words, in the same way, we inaugurate the Shabbos by lighting the menorah. Right? We light the menorah. Now, before we get into Shabbos, people have a custom of washing, of going to the mikveh, of purifying ourselves. And then we change our clothing, just like when you went into the Beis Hamikdash, the Kohanim wore special clothing. When we enter Shabbos, we wear special clothing. What did they have in the temple? They had this big table with loaves on it. What kind of loaf? That was challah. So the symbolism on Shabbos is that we are in the temple. On Shabbos, when we light the candles, we are the lady of the house is like the Kohen Gadol, and she's lighting the candles of making the divine presence come down into the house. And we're having the loaves on the table, and we got the salt there, and the utensils that, in other words, we're working that our daily lives, we should be the place where Hashem's presence rests, that Hashem should be comfortable with our what we do and how we live our lives, and that we should be a reflection, a place where He's comfortable residing amongst us in our home. And so the utensils that, you know, we have, the people have their china and their nice things, and they bring them out Friday night, and that's, in a certain way, that's a miniature of what took place in the Beis Hamikdash with the utensils. And, you know, you go to someone's house, they say, this was my mother's china, or this was, I got this on my anniversary, or I got this when I was here, and it's a beautiful piece. So the things, the utensils in the Beis Hamikdash were like that as well. In other words, these were, every utensil was special, was unique, it was fancy. And so it kind of describes these utensils that were here.
Is the source for this explanation, is that the talent?
I would say there are hints to it in the Talmud, but I think these ideas you see in the Rishonim, like the Nachmanides or Maimonides. I think they both echo that kind of thought. I could have to research tell you the exact place.
Even in the temple, these things were done every day.
So, well, a lot of them were done at different times. In other words, they had large supplies that were made. Initially, when they made it, it's like when you do a new house, when you do something new, you try to have a lot to last for. And then we see from the Haftorah that after a while, things fell into disrepair, and they do a new building campaign to get a new... there are people still today that talk about when we got the shul dishes, how they took it to the mikvah, and how much work was involved, and selecting the pattern, and because it was special. It was a unique thing to choose the pattern, or to be involved in the work of setting up the building, or research. You know, that is... Oh, you chose the dishes? Okay. One of the few, right? Okay.
Every one of those dishes was a problem.
I remember they had to check them for imperfections because some of them were chipped or something.
Just getting the money together to buy the thing. It took years of a lot of work. When I walk in sometimes at the dinners and I see the tables all set and everything, and I smell as if it was my own house, and I loved it for Shabbos or something, because it's so beautiful, and I know how hard everybody works.
So we believe there's a holiness to that, and that's why, you know, you can't compare, like, being at your Shabbos table or a person's table to, you know, going to a restaurant or out to eat, or to, because there's so much love and so much work that goes into establishing a household or an edifice.
Well, I mean, since they were every day, why do we emulate that?
Okay, there's a much deeper discussion, but Shabbos is in time what the Beis Hamikdash was in place, which means that really God is everywhere, so why would we make it in one place more than other places? And the answer is that even though He can be felt everywhere, there are certain places where He can be felt more intense. And so the same thing is true of time. time, God is in all time, but there are certain times where we feel Him stronger. The Shabbos is that time where, just like the Beis HaMikdash was that place where we feel it more intense, Shabbos is the time when we can somehow in the middle of the week, you know, if you have a a Super Bowl party, it's just not the same as Friday night, you know. It's you bring out the dishes and everything, it just doesn't have the sanctity of the...
In addition to the bracha over the candle, there's a little prayer that some women say. And in the midst of it, it says, and of course, thy divine presence dwells in our midst.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I always look up at that point because it's one of the candles that you give a little sliver.
Oh, really? Okay, that's it. It comes down.
And then I just like watching the cup of wine at the Seder, you know, does it have a ripple on it? Is that the other really here? It's like the same thing. And usually, if you think about it, it's probably because you're breathing in front of the candle. But that in itself has some significance in the same breath, you know. So,
in shul, there's a point where they turn towards the door. That's in order to greet the Shabbos. And so some like to feel that the Shabbos is coming in at that time. It's a similar kind of idea. It's called Mos because we, by the time we daven, it's already Shabbos many times. But they would daven Kavod Shabbos beforehand. And so they see the sun going down as they turn to the hills and see the, you know, to greet the Shabbos. It was a little bit more of a, they sensed that it was coming. Okay. So we're here in 40. So Kira made these different, we're talking here about the small wares. The Kiros, the Yoya, Mizrochos, these were the shovels, the bowls, the number of utensils. The Chalkir, Matas, Komalach, Asher, Asher, the Melech, Shlomo, Beis Hashem. And Kira finished all the job that he had to do. Now we mentioned again the two big pillars. I never showed you that. I'm always hesitant because we don't really... He doesn't even show them as two, but he shows you like what the top looked like. He calls that the capital, like on top of the pillar. You know, that's the way he has the, like a crown kind of. But these pillars were the first things that you would see as you walked into the Beis HaMikdash. And so again, he describes the two pillars. It goes, Tamashal, Rosh, Amudim, Stein, Basho, Stein, Beheshte, and there were covers to the tops of the pillars that were on the beams. Now, and then he describes the pomegranates, 42. That's Rimonim, Arba Meos, Lashte, Hashofos. They had different pomegranates hanging on the nettings. They're mentioned also, he says that there were all kinds of plants around the Beis HaMikdash, trees, fruit trees around the Beis HaMikdash, Shlomo planted, and they gave forth fruits. We're just not used to seeing that part of nature we mentioned before that Shlomo called it the forest of the Lebanon, and so that there definitely were nature, parts of nature that were involved over here. But he describes these pomegranates, Shnei Rimon Shafa that were on the hanging from the pillars, the Kathesh, they were Sarah Michelle, Tanei Amudim. And then it gets back to the wash basins, the 10, that's Kiris the Surah, and you had the platform plus the basins that were on top of them. That's the Yam, and you had the sea, that's the Bukhar, and you had the 12. Under the sea, you had these cows. Now, if they were done by hand and they were done with copper, it was very slow. Each one was a work of, if you've ever been to Stone Mountain, and they talk about how they started the project and then it stopped and then they started again and then it stopped and it took, you know, somebody had to be like upside down on a rope on a scaffold, you know, hanging from there, chiseling away, like they, you know, it was a very long labor that went into, you know, just the chiseling of those. So in a similar way, it's hard to appreciate all the work that went into each one of these items that they made, these 12 cows that were, the 12, we mentioned the symbolism of the 12 tribes. That each one of the tribes was there. 45.
I didn't quite understand the speciality of the pomegranate. I mean, in our day, it's a very dry fruit. It has, you know, there's nothing terribly interesting or special.
So there's interesting symbolism. But first of all, it says that when the temple was destroyed, the fruits lost their splendor. In other words, there were certain fruits that grew in the land of Israel in such a unique way. It says that the spies brought back the fruits to give people an idea. They'd never seen produce like that. It took more than one person to carry a cluster of grapes. Like, it's unbelievable. But the pomegranates, the symbolism is that there are so many of them inside. In other words, you eat the fruits, and then you open it up, and there's another cluster, and there's another cluster. They say the symbolism, it says that even there, you can't find, even the most simple Jew is compared to a pomegranate, that you think that you know all of their good deeds. If you'd open them up more, there are more good deeds, and more good deeds, and more. It's symbolism of the, that every person does good things, or has merits that we may not be aware of, or that you just, you know, if you would know that there are a lot of people that you wouldn't suspect that just are very kind or very good in different ways, and they're full of mitzvahs like a pomegranate. The kids have a legend that if you're 613. So I know someone who told me that they got one in Israel. They opened one and they found 613. But I can't tell you I've ever.
It's one of the few fruits on the plant that has the Star of David on its first bud. When you look at it, when it first blossoms and you see the fruit, has a Magen David.
Really?
If you cut an apple in a certain way, you'll see an American star. But he's got a pomegranate with Magen David.
Really?
Very symbolic.
Can you see that when you buy him or sometimes?
When it's first budding, you can see the flowers exactly the Star of David.
Really, fascinating. Okay, I'll have to try that. Okay.
Isn't the pomegranate one of the symbols that you put out on Rosh Hashanah?
Yeah.
That's
right.
That's
the Seiris, that's the Yom. So now we're describing the pots and the pans and the mizrachot. It says, Kol HaKelim Ol Ela, Asher Asaf Kimel Melech. They were brought into the tent. Now, somewhat, the Beis HaMikdash was a tent in that a tent was a temporary dwelling. We knew that Hashem was not making a permanent decision of being in our midst. It was only if we were worthy of Him. And from time to time in history, when we're not worthy of it, I'm packing up my bags and I'm going. And that's what happened. And we're hopeful that we'll get him back again. They say the third time when he comes back, it'll be for good. So that's the goal. And all of this was made from this copper. He calls it a pure copper. They describe that a lot of metals have parts of other metals mixed in, and so if they melt it down, they're able to get the impurities out. And I think it's called smelting or smeltering. Where did they do this? He describes the place where they did it. I think, is it the copper mines? I think they found some of them today. The mines are the place where they were able, because this was a huge undertaking. There needed to have been the amount that was needed. But Yonah Shlomo's Kol HaKelim Rov Ma'od Ma'od. Now, Shlomo was an amazing builder. Like, it said, describes it as Ma'od. Ma'od means a lot. Ma'od means, like, you can't imagine. They stopped counting after a while. The Yashon's Kol HaShedes, and all the vessels that he made, they were stored there. Now, I don't know where the storage was. You know, they must have had closets, or they had the rooms around. He stored them in, together with the golden mizbeach, with the shulchan, and there was the table, a show of lechem upon him, that had the show, they call it the showbread. I don't know the significance. I'm still working on this too. But like I said, we all are so distant from so many of these things. Why is it called the showbread? I don't even know why they call it the showbread. The Hebrew word is called lechem hapanim, the bread. Now, the word panim means face, the face bread. So why would it be called face bread? It was made from different, but I don't have, okay, there's a theory. I can tell by your face that you have it.
I think this represents, when you talk about the tribes also represent the constellations,
mm-hmm.
and also it's going to single out different planets,
mm-hmm.
and the planets operate not only in tandem, but they are polarities of one another.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see like the circle of the zodiac and the one adjacent where they're facing each other, I think the showbread actually represents
the tribes, the plants, the mud, you know, it takes it, you know, the koalas all the way through the system that they're facing. It's the polarities because they work, even though they're polarized, they work complementary to one another. It's like the man and the wife.
They face each other. Yes. The cherubs face.
Yes. And each will be, one will be a male and one will be a female. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that now you can get into the fruit. I mean, you can just move on and on and on.
The showbread, it was not bread, by the way. It was matzah, first of all. In other words, it didn't...
Soft matzah,
right. And it says that it was a special... it was made in a special way that they could not find... there was one family that knew the secret, how to build it. And they didn't want to give out the secret because they were afraid that people that went over to idolatry would offer these loaves. They were such beautiful loaves. First of all, they kept fresh all week long without preservatives. They never went to... That's a pretty good thing, you know. They were afraid, this is what they said, which is that there were Jews who would spend 1 week in the temple, and then when they were in Rome, they would spend a week over at the Zeus. And they didn't want to give off the special secret of how to make this divine bread because they thought then it would end up in the temple for the idols. What happened was that they wanted, they were unable to get these specialists to do it, and they were trying to see if someone else could make it, and they couldn't. They had to seek out the people who knew the secret how to do it, how to, apparently they wanted to raise, you know, they wanted to be paid more for their baking skills or the, but it would, they were a unique, kind of, bread, but it is called face bread. And, I have to think about what you're saying is fascinating, it is deep, but I didn't see any commentary really, anyone, but I'm sure there is, you know, about what the significance of the face spread was, but that was on the table when you walked into the Beit HaMikdash.
Maybe it's that, because it wasn't eaten, it was just seen for the whole week.
It was, but on Shabbos it was eaten,
right, but it was, I mean, for
people faced it, I see. Okay.
No, I mean, it was showbread. In other words, you looked at it, but you didn't eat it until 7 days later.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think this is the shulchan we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we learned another shiurim about that symbolized work. That mm-hmm. the shulchan symbolized, there was the aron, which was the Torah, the written Torah, mm-hmm. and the shulchan was the rabbis. Guest rabbi spoke about this Shabbos. Mm-hmm. It was avodah, and the menorah was like the intellect and mm-hmm. another level. So the shulchan with the bread symbolized making your bread, like making mm-hmm. a living, kind of
mm-hmm.
thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So does that fit into this also? Is that
so where does it fit in with the faith, or just in general?
But yeah, I'm just wondering if that. Cause I know the word mm-hmm. went into formation too, but it's got to be.
Yeah, so that's.
The rabbis didn't address the bread, but they addressed the table.
The table. There's a lot of discussion on about the table. Yeah, that's the menorah's coming now. There is a question. There's a big debate about what the menorah looked like. And some people point out in the there's a picture of the menorah on the Roman ark that they built when they. So there's a question whether that was the menorah or a menorah, because actually there were many menorahs. And we see that right over here in verse 49. Mm-hmm. There were five on the right, and Chamesh Mismoil, and there were five on the left. Mm-hmm. We have a tradition that when they understood that the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, the people knew when they had these superpowers coming against them, and they had overridden the country several times, that eventually they saw that there was a downfall. In other words, the people saw that it was coming. And they hid away the vessels, the original vessels that Moshe Rabbeinu had created, they hid away because they didn't want them used to be paraded in front of the idols. That's what when the pagans would conquer the Beit HaMikdash, that's what they did. In fact, when they conquered King Shaul, they nailed his body up in front of the idols. And there were Jewish heroes that went in the middle of the night and fought their way through to take the body down and bury it because they felt such a chilul Hashem to have the anointed king of Israel hanging there in front of the idols. And I think I mentioned it, they actually found the temple to the idols where that took place. They had the relics of that today. they knew that the temple was going to be destroyed. And one of the things that, you know, that when you go to Israel and you see the tunnels, we have the understanding was that they built an underground tunnel to hide the Aram, you know, with the Ten Commandments in it, and it's there. It might be under the area where the Arabs have it. That's why there's so many Jews that have this passion, you know, keep on digging. You know, it's got it. We know it's there because it hasn't been found. And that area is largely unexplored. And so we're hopeful any one of these days that it will be discovered. And what we would do with it, I don't know. You know, that they discovered there was underground tunnels where they hid some of the artifacts from Moshe Rabbeinu. But yes, many people feel that that's so. We're not, you know, we turn it into a museum or something. But they have the menorah 5 on the right, and 5 on the left is from the Jewish Sabbath Peres Vaneres. And you have the gold and the flowers and the lamps and the hokayim and the gold, basam mizmoros and mizrachos, and the musical instruments and the jugs and the kapos and the zav sogav apsu. The musical instruments were also part of the work that was built for the temple. Now we get to verse 51.
Yep. There were 5 menorahs on each side at the same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Tashlam Kol HaMalacha, they finished all the work. That's also, they finished the building, finally. They finished all the work, Asha'asa Melech Shlomo Beis Hashem. They finally finished. He did the job, and they finished all of the little things and the small wares. V'yavu Shlomo Kachei David Avid, and Shlomo brought the things that his father had dedicated, as the kesef et zev, the gold and the silver came, and he put these, b'otzros beis Hashem. He put them in the treasure house of the house of Hashem. So there's a lot of questions we have to ask here. It sounds like he didn't use his father's gold and silver. It says he put it here for still, like he put it in the bank. So why didn't he use David HaMelech's gold and silver for the construction? Why? And David was doing thought, you know, he put all the gold and silver there so that they would have it to build the Beis HaMikdash. And what does Shlomo do? He says, you know, he puts it away. So they're very interesting commentators. They go both ways with this, why he did that. So one view is that Shlomo knew that the Beis HaMikdash wouldn't last. And he didn't want that the pagans would ever get the things that came from his father who had fought. And so it was because they were so special that he didn't use it. Other people say, and this is the Mayim Lois, he quotes it, very fascinating thing, that in David's time there was a famine. We have a rule that if people are dying, you sell the sacred Torah to save lives. There's nothing that comes before saving Jewish life. Somebody's life is in danger, somebody needs, you know, assistance. And he felt that David stored all of this wealth, and there were people that were dying for lack of food. And so he said, we can't use that in Hashem's house. David should have spent the money to save the life. Isn't that amazing? Like, there's such a strong, you know, but therefore he felt that it was tainted, because if people were dying, he would have sold all the gold and silver and used it for saving lives. And it gives a person pause, you know, that you always have to put, you know, things in perspective. You know, the life, you know, saving a life comes first. But that's a very strong, you know, strong way to look at it. There's an interesting medrash over here on this verse that we just quoted, 51, the last verse, where it says they finished. It doesn't say they finished the work. It says they finished all the work. It should just say they finished the job. What is all of the job? So one verse is that the world was waiting from the 6 days of creation for there to be a Jewish nation that would have a place where Hashem's most intense presence would reside, where Hashem would be welcome to come in. And so this was really the pinnacle of creation, that as a nation we were ready to have Hashem be part of us. And that's why it says kol. And he brings down a second explanation, that it says the world stands on three pillars. And with the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, he ensured that the world would be strong. It would stand. Sometimes we wonder if our world's coming to pieces. Every now and then they have these revolutions and other things that are happening. It says in the Gemara, mentions that if the Gentiles had any idea how good for them it was to have the temple, they would have never allowed it to be destroyed. In other words, the blessing comes to the world. The temple is not a Jewish idea. In fact, it's called the temple was called the house for all nations. And the nation, the Jew and Gentile, would come to the temple to be inspired. And it was a different vision than we always have. But within the temple, you had the three pillars of the world that were strengthened. What are the three pillars of the world? So you have Torah, Avoda, and Gemilas Chasadim. Those are the three that are mentioned in the Pirkei Avos. So the Torah, the Sanhedrin was located, the court that taught Torah, that was located right next to the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, if you look at the parshas in the Torah, right after Yisro, where the Torah is given, is followed immediately with the construction of the temple. And the Rashi says, why are they together? Because the Jewish court was right next to the place where they taught Torah and the laws. The place where the law comes from is from Hashem, who's in the temple. And so we say, like, Ki Mitzio Teitei Torah, the reason why Torah comes out of Yerushalayim is because that's where Hashem, Torah comes from, an awareness of Hashem. In other words, our Torah wisdom is, we believe that you can't just be a person who's knowledgeable to understand Torah, but you have to be pious also. That Torah wisdom comes to a person that is somebody that doesn't just talk to somebody that is worth is a who lives the Torah, then he'll come to understand the Torah. In other words, if a person is caring and good and kind and humble, so then he can be knowledgeable in Torah. But if a person is arrogant and nasty and not giving, so he might have knowledge. The Gemara describes it as like a donkey with books on its back. It's still a donkey. The wisdom doesn't do it any good. The Torah has to. So our understanding is that there was Torah next to the temple to signify that the Torah wisdom comes from being godlike, being in the image of Hashem. So you had the temple, and then you had these great Sanhedrin, which taught Torah, which had rows and rows of people that would come up and study. That was the Torah. Now, in the Beis HaMikdash, we had prayer. That's what we call avoda. That's where the people would pray. And it's interesting, the word it's not prayer. Avoda means work. Because the service of Hashem involved, it was a job. It took some work. The third thing, which I hadn't realized, and those two are no surprise, the temple was the place where good deeds were done. It was the source of. So there's some people describe that they had a room there where if you needed money, you could get money, and if you wanted to give money, you could give money, and nobody asked any questions. In other words, on your way out of the temple, everybody came up to the temple. So if somebody was needy, they could go in and they would be given. They would be given charity. If, on the other hand, nobody knew if they were giving or taking. And one of the things that we read, we'll see later, that whenever the foreign king came by, they wanted to get the temple treasury, because that's where people gave the money to help the poor. Was the funds were there? There were two gates he mentioned that Shlomo set up. One was for mourners, and the other one was for chasanim, for grooms, and the Jewish people would come up to the temple, and when people were mourning, this way people would know that person experienced a loss. And we have a custom like that to this day on Friday night when a person is mourning and they come to synagogue. It's actually embarrassing. It's not embarrassing, but it's awkward that the whole synagogue stops and they turn and they watch the mourner walk in. And the purpose of that is that people need to be aware that somebody's experienced a loss. That some people, they don't know what's going on with their fellow person. They didn't know that. I mean, today we have internet. Before they had email, you went to shul and, oh my goodness, so-and-so's mourning? Well, how can I help them? What can we do? You know, there are orphans to take care of. There's a widow to take care of. There's somebody experienced a loss. So they had a special gate where the mourners would walk through, and people knew that these people needed help because they just experienced a loss in their life. And so that was the gate of the mourners. And with the grooms, the young people starting off, there, that was an order that people know to wish them mazel tov and to help them start off life. Well, they're just starting off. Maybe he needs a job. Maybe he needs, maybe she needs advice how to prepare, you know, to do things, or to, maybe they need help. And we also have this custom that we make a big deal about a groom before, bride and groom before they get married. We have a special, the Shabbos before the wedding. We always have, they get Nalia, and they have the, and it comes from the, it goes back to the Beis Hamikdash, where we seek to help people in stages in life where the community could be part of their simcha or as part of their helping them through the difficult times. In other words, the goal is to rejoice with people on the happy times and to help them through the difficult times. And so when Shlomo built the Beis Hamikdash, there was the mourner's gate and there was the groom's gate, a special place for each one, so that we were all like one big family. So that's interesting. It mentions that separately.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.